Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
The surf is up. The sun is out.
Summer is on.
It's our annual summer reading show.
Fiction.
Nonfiction.
Philosophical titles.
That novel you can't put down.
50 Shades of Grey by E.L. James. Read by Ellen DeGeneres.
What better way to spend a summer evening than curled up with a good philosophy book?
Bathe in the summer sun as you while away the hours exploring the upper reaches of philosophical thought.
He grabs me suddenly and yanks me up against him. One hand at my back holding me to him and the other hand... Oh my God, I'm not going to say that.
What book should thoughtful people be reading this summer?
Is it okay if I paraphrase so that I don't say the exact words, but it's just more like... I'm going to put it in my own words.
This summer... Tend to the gardens of your mind by reading a good philosophy book or two.
Thank God there are no pictures in here. This is...
It's a philosophical summer reading list.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're in San Francisco. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW.
Continuing conversations that begin on the Stanford campus at Philosopher's Corner, where Ken and I teach.
Today, our 7th annual summer reading show.
Every year, with the help of some distinguished guests and with the help of you, our listeners, we compile a philosophical summer reading list.
You know, I have to admit, John, I start out with the best of intentions every single summer, but my reading list often turns out to be more aspirational than actual.
Well, Ken, you better set your aspirations really high this year. Our listeners nominated over 80 different titles for our list.
80 titles? I'll never get through 80 books this summer.
Well, we won't even get through 80 titles on this show, but it just shows what voracious and ambitious readers our listeners are.
And even the books we will get to run the gamut, John, from baseball and whaling to the psychology of testimony and the history of violence, with a stop or two for pure philosophy along the way.
So let's get started.
And what better way than with our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Esch? We sent her to the beach, where she found out what people in bathing suits and sunglasses are really reading. She files this report.
A few weeks ago, I was sitting in the shade on a beach in Northern California, switching off between Stacy Schiff's incredible biography of Cleopatra and the New York Times ebook bestseller, 50 Shades of Grey. Cleopatra meticulously traces the life of a woman we're still talking about 2,000 years later. She came to power at the age of 18 during the decline of an empire. She married two of her brothers and then had them killed. 50 Shades of Grey, on the other hand, is a poorly written erotic novel. It's been described as the Lady Chatterley's Lover of 2012. The book is surprisingly popular, but it's racy, and some libraries across the country are even refusing to carry it. It got me wondering, what are other people on the beach reading? Turns out they're reading memoirs by the TV executive behind the Real Housewives franchise.
It's called Most Talkative by Andy Cohen.
They're reading do-it-yourself manuals.
I'm reading a book called How to Restore Your Datsun Z Car, and it's a restoration how-to book.
Romance paperbacks, of course.
A book by Robin Carr called Redwood Bend.
And young adult smash hits.
I am at Simpson Beach reading Catching Fire. It's the second book of The Hunger Games.
The Hunger Games, of course, is a wildly popular trilogy by Suzanne Collins. It's about a young woman who navigates the life of poverty, violence, and unexpected fame in the post-apocalyptic country of Pan Am.
I'm only 24 pages in, but it's really good. It's really easy to imagine this world that doesn't really exist, but we can all try and compare at different places, you know, not agreeing with the government or falling in love with maybe two people at the same time. Certain people, especially like my age, I'm 19, we can agree with some things that she says and kind of relate to it.
Then there were a few surprises.
I'm reading In the Garden of Beasts by Eric Lawson.
This young mother of twin boys hired a babysitter so she could sit on the beach and read a book that chronicles Hitler's first year in power. The book tells the tale of William Dodd, whom FDR appointed ambassador to Nazi Germany in 1933. Dodd brings along his wife, son, and party girl daughter. The family lives life amidst the backdrop of growing terror and oppression.
I studied kind of totalitarian regimes when I was in college, and I always think it's interesting kind of the psychological study of it, how the everyday life can yield to authoritarianism.
Farther down the beach, there was a woman sitting against a piece of driftwood while her friends were surfing.
I'm not surfing because I'm 7 months pregnant. I am reading an erotic memoir by Tony Bentley called Surrender.
The Surrender is in the style of extreme female confessions. It's about a former ballerina who gives herself up to sexual taboos and writes about it graphically.
Which I just think is a very interesting premise for a book. And so does the New York Times, because it was a notable book of the year.
That should give you a few ideas of what to read this summer. Perhaps not the most philosophical, but certainly beach-worthy. I'm Caitlin Esch. Now back to John and Ken and Philosophy Talk.
Thanks, Caitlin. Ken, it looks like, according to Caitlin, it's our job to get philosophy read on the beach this summer. It's not going to happen without us. I'm John Perry. By my side, Ken Taylor, my fellow philosopher from Stanford University.
And this is our 7th annual summer reading show.
We're joined now by Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein. She's a prolific writer, author most recently of 36 Arguments for the Existence of God, a work of fiction. Rebecca, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So what's on your mind? What do you want to tell our vast listening audience they should read this summer?
Well, I've got one book that's, it was published in 1993, but I just got around to reading it because the title had completely misled me. It's Colin McGinn's Problems in Philosophy, The Limits of Inquiry. And I just thought it was going to be a sort of introduction to problems in philosophy. And instead, it is this really fascinating meta-philosophical look at why philosophical problems pose the difficulties that they do for us.
Now, usually I think that meta-philosophy is like, what's the right word? Completely boring. I mean, for crying out loud, philosophy is hard enough. Who wants to do meta-philosophy?
Yeah. I realized when I read McGinn's book that one of the reasons that I embed philosophy all the time in novels, or very often do that, is that I'm interested in the psychology of philosophy and why we have such very different intuitions in philosophy, and that I have been all along pursuing the idea that it comes out of our character. And reading that book, it made things a lot more clear for me in terms of why I think philosophical novels can be interesting. It's a mismatch between our cognitive faculties and this particular problem, that there's nothing particularly problematic about these problems, but they're mysterious to us because we just don't have the cognitive wherewithal to deal with them.
Now, is that or is that not a fancy way of saying many philosophical problems are insolvable because we're too dumb for them? Or we don't have the right equipment for them.
We don't have the right equipment. He does say that. He really does say that. And then he goes through not just, problem of consciousness, which he treats as a kind of paradigmatic philosophical problem, but problem of meaning, the a priori, freedom of will, trying to show that we have intuitions that we just can't justify, and it has to do with our own cognitive limitations.
Now, that line seems to me extraordinarily implausible because our minds obviously weren't evolved for zillions of the things that we've managed to do with them, like physics and astronomy and double entry bookkeeping. I mean, it's amazing that we can do any of that stuff as well as we can. But given that, it would be even more amazing if there was something special about philosophical problems that put them out of reach of this rather fantastic cognitive ability that we accidentally came to have.
But look at it this way, John and Rebecca. Philosophical problems are the leftover ones. There are problems we make progress on over time, and they turn into science and politics or whatever. And then there's these leftover ones that we have no clue about, and the philosophy problems are the leftover ones.
Well, I think there's more to it than that. And, I think that the question that you posed about how our brains didn't evolve to do string theory, and yet here we are doing string theory, he would have to come back with, there's something different about those problems that we can get to the physics problems by analogic reasoning, perhaps metaphoric reasoning, whereas these problems, we can't solve in that way.
Rebecca, I will definitely put his book in my book bag, perhaps near the bottom. Near the top, I wonder if there's going to be a new book by you coming out soon or that has just come out I could throw in.
Oh, there is hopefully going to be a manuscript finished this summer. It's a book sort of on Plato. That's what my editor had wanted. He'd heard me talk about Plato, and he asked me to write a book on Plato, and I felt, oh my gosh, who needs another book on Plato? So this book is called Dialogues Out of Time, Why Plato Won't Go Away, and it intersperses expository chapters with dialogues where Plato is in our day talking to us. I did one where he's at the Googleplex talking about crowdsourcing and can that help us with ethics. He's at the 92nd Street Y on a panel with somebody who bears some similarity to the Tiger Mom talking about how to raise the perfect child, things like that.
Wow.
So let me ask you a question. Is your Plato, the Plato of your book, is he as much fun as the Socrates of Plato's dialogue?
I hope he's a lot of fun. I hope I had to give him a lot of dignity. I imagine Plato having a lot of dignity. And yeah. Can I just drop in one other book?
I bet I know what's coming. Okay, yeah, you can drop in one other book.
Okay. Now, this may be interpreted as nepotistic, but Steve Pinker's The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined, is it's not exactly beach reading, but I think it's an extraordinarily important book.
I have read a lot about it. I haven't gotten around to reading it. I have it on my shelf, as I always, because whenever your husband Steve writes a book, I feel like I got to get around to reading it. But, you know, it's one thing about that book puzzles me. I know he has an answer to this, but, you know, I take the Holocaust, Stalin's genocide, the Cultural Revolution, maybe like crime and rape has declined, but large-scale violence.
He doesn't ignore that, but he's got sophisticated statistical analyses to deal with it.
You are totally right that he has an answer to that, which is, you know, when you look at long scales, it even when you factor in what, you know, is undeniable about what happened in the middle of the last century, it still goes down. I mean, he's got the statistics, but he's obviously, it's Steven Pinker, he's obviously not claiming that human nature has changed and the demons are always there. But what he particularly wants to do is try to analyze what we're doing right when things are going right and what we're doing wrong when things go horrifically wrong.
Well, that's a hopeful note. So I'm going to thank you for that nepotistic recommendation. But like I said, Steve's one of my favorite authors, so I don't think there's anything wrong with nepotism. It's overdetermined in this case.
Great.
So, Rebecca, it's always a pleasure. And thank you for your recommendation of Colin McGinn's book, The Problems of Philosophy. And thank you for all the fine things you've written.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That was Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein, author most recently of 36 Arguments for the Existence of God, a Work of Fiction.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're putting together our annual summer reading list.
What's on your list? Are you still looking for something to get you started? We've got lots of ideas. After the break, we'll talk fiction, and we'll get suggestions from listeners and guests, and discuss a new book that Ken and I both admire.
Philosophical Fiction, when Philosophy Talk continues.
I can't remember when, but one of these days I'm going to do it again. Yes, sir. One of these days I'm going to do it again.
It's the Summer Reading List edition of Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. What thoughtful reading will you tackle this summer? The latest research on the meaning of life? One of the classics you've never read in school? If you were going to read only one philosophically rich book this summer, what would it be?
We're joined now by a fellow who has a suggestion for you. Hilton Obersinger teaches literature at Stanford University. He's also a writer. His most recent book is the autobiographical novel, Busy Dying. Hilton, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So I hear you got a great recommendation for us for our summer reading list. What would you like to recommend to our vast listening audience?
Well, of course, Moby Dick.
Moby Dick by Herman Melville.
You bet.
You know, I can hear a lot of people saying, Moby Dick, isn't that one of those books they make you read in high school and college? I don't know. I want something more contemporary, more of a potboiler. What would your response to that be?
Well, first of all, big mistake to force people to read Moby Dick in high school. There are ways of reading it in college and beyond. But the key to reading the book for people who are often very intimidated by the book. Oh, my God, it's Moby Dick. It's this heavy duty.
700 pages.
Yes, very serious book. The key thing is that when you come to a section in Moby Dick that you're having trouble, you're trying to figure out what is he talking about? Because there are a number of these essays on, the whiteness of the whale or various, how whaling operates, whatever, that that you skim it.
But why on earth should a philosophically minded person want to put this book on their summer reading list?
Well, I think one of the main philosophical themes is how do you know the world and what do you do about it? And can you know the world and can you do something about it in a very general sense? And the sense that we all live on the edge of death. And have to be aware of that. There are a number of, all men live enveloped in whale lines. All are born with halters round their necks. So this sense of really this immediacy and predating perhaps Kierkegaard and existentialism, that sense of living on the edge.
Well, Hilton, I did read it for the first time a couple of years ago, and I think you are absolutely right. It is an adult book. It's fascinating. I really could have used your permission to skim some of those chapters on whaling, but I did make it through. It's a wonderful book, very philosophical, and if you haven't read Moby Dick, this is the summer to do it. Don't you agree, Ken?
I certainly agree. And as a matter of fact, I think this is one of the deepest novels. It's about the nature of the self, about the nature of society. I mean, these guys are out at sea, out on the ocean, where all the normal rules are broken. And they have to form this society together to do this very hard collective thing. And there's this obsessed, maniacal captain at the head, and there's this elusive object that he is utterly determined to bring down, but that elusive object is very, very dangerous. It raises all kinds of issues. And I'm going to read this book again. I'm about 150 pages into it.
Oh, great.
It is hilarious. It's extraordinarily well written. It's a great read. I did not remember how great a read this book is.
Well, as he says, in terms of it being hilarious, there are certain queer times and occasions in this strange mixed affair we call life when a man takes this whole universe for a vast practical joke.
Right.
Though the wit thereof he but dimly discerns and more than suspects that the joke is at nobody's expense but his own.
And there's one thing I want to ask you about that I didn't remember from my youth. Maybe being at Catholic Notre Dame, we wouldn't have focused on this. But there's a certain, I wouldn't even call it undercurrent, there's a current of homoeroticism running throughout that book. Am I misreading that, or is that
No, there's been a lot of discussion of it. There's that one scene where they're massaging the case, the kind of jellied over whale oil, and they're touching each other's hands, squeeze the sperm, because it's a sperm whale. Or when Ishmael meets Queequeg and they end up in bed together, and Queequeg puts his arm around him. And so there's all of this kind of affectionate and homoerotic dynamic going on, for sure, among all kinds of other social dynamics, colonialism, industrial production, all kinds of dynamics. But that's definitely one of them. Right. And remember, Herman Melville was 31 when he wrote the book.
Oh, that's really a depressing thought. But did he do any great things after that?
He did do a lot of great things. But, Moby Dick was not a big hit when it came out. His big hit was his very first book, Living, Typee, when he was living among the cannibals. But he wrote terrific stuff. And another philosophical one, if you can really put up with it, it's a difficult book, is his Clarel, which is a poem in pilgrimage to the Holy Land. And that's a poem around 500 pages long, debating on a pilgrimage from Jerusalem, etc., all of the religions of the world, Hinduism, Catholicism.
That sounds more like a winter reading list.
So, Hilton, thanks for that suggestion, Moby Dick by Herman Melville. It's a great book and a great read, and thanks for joining us.
All right, well, thank you. Enjoy the voyage.
Shiver me timbers, I'm a sailing, oh.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're compiling our annual summer reading list.
Ken, I just finished a book you told me about. I didn't wait till summer to read it. It's called The Art of Fielding by Chad Harbach. It's a great novel.
It is a great novel. I'm reading this on my wife's recommendation. And she said, if you're going to talk about Moby Dick, which is all about whaling, this book is the baseball, what Moby Dick is the whaling. You think that's right?
Well, yeah, it is. In the first place, it's a long book like Moby Dick. In the second place, it's a book that's mainly about men thrown together in a situation where they don't come together because they're friends or have a lot of other interests, but just because they're on the same baseball team. Of course, they're men. They really start out as teenagers, college students. I guess those are men. And also, there's a connection with Moby Dick because one of the characters is an expert on Melville.
Right. The president of the college is an expert on Melville. Again, Moby Dick, the homoeroticism of Moby Dick, I got it on the second read when I was a grown-up, but when I was in college and read this, I didn't really get this. But here, it's kind of beat you over the head a little bit.
It's hard to miss, yes. But it's not the main theme of the book.
No, it's not the main theme. It has similar themes to Moby Dick. The passionate pursuit of this elusive goal and what it takes to persevere in this passionate pursuit and disappointment and loss. It's this kind of book like Moby Dick, this hard task, takes a lot of talent. You're put to the test. Some succeed, some fail.
The title of the book, The Art of Fielding, is also the title of a book that plays an important role in the book. This is a book called The Art of Fielding by the world's greatest shortstop who was named Rodriguez Aparicio. But anyway, this is a book of wisdom written in a like some cross between the Tao Te Ching and Wittgenstein's Investigations. It's the only book the main character has ever read till he gets to college. And it treats like baseball, in particular being an infielder, as the most important thing in the world and one of these things that you can only master by getting so good at it you don't even have to think about what you're doing.
So just like Moby Dick. Moby Dick is very, very detailed about whaling, you know, and the beauty and art and difficulty of whaling. This book is very detailed in its descriptions of things happening in baseball. But I think of baseball as really the subtext of this book rather than the text. I mean, would you agree?
Well, yeah, because one of the main characters in the book, all the characters aren't men. There's a character, Pella, who plays a very important role in the book because she's the one who kind of isn't involved in baseball and has what one might think of as a philosophical take on it. I'm reminded of Tom Nagel's essay about the absurd, which is that when you're involved in things, they don't seem absurd, but when you take a step back, it seems very odd to imagine how involved you were. I'm just scratching the surface of Nagel's rich essay. But Pella is the one who kind of, you know, is a very close relation with some of these people that are involved in baseball. But the whole thing strikes her as incredibly odd and absurd. And that's also true to a certain extent of Owen, one of the baseball players, that they both take this step back that the others don't take.
Even though, oh, you're right, Owen takes a step back and he's distanced from it in a way that Schwartz and Henry, the other two main characters in this book, are not. But he's damaged by it in a certain way because of his distance from it. Because one of the main and important events in the book, he gets injured by an errant throw from Henry, who never makes an errant throw, while he's sitting in the dugout at a game reading. Because that's what he does. He reads, and he hits. He hits like a demon.
He's a good enough hitter that the coach allows him to read against all the rules in the dugout. And maybe there's a lesson there for philosophers, right? I mean, it's fine to rise above the world and analyze it and look at it from this odd perspective we have, but watch out, you may get hit in the face with a baseball.
It defines your life. These absurd things can define your life, can define what counts as success and failure and loss. And that's about the human condition, right? Where there are these things that objectively maybe they have no deep meaning. It's not the universe endowing these things with meaning. It's merely our own doing. And from some perspective, that's just absurd, but that's what we do. We define our lives in terms of these otherwise utterly meaningless things.
We're talking about The Art of Fielding by Chad Harbach. I read it in a Kindle edition, by the way, which was a very good experience. And the Kindle edition had a nice interview with the author at the end, which was interesting.
Oh, that surprises me. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think of you as, you know, I always want the latest gadget, the biggest processor, the fanciest screen. I think of you, I don't think of you as a Luddite, but I don't think of you as a guy who's eager to get the latest gadget.
No, I'm not eager to get the latest gadget, and I really enjoy books. You know, my house is full of books. I spend a lot of my time toting books around from place to place for no good reason. But the Kindle is what, I mean, I've come to like the Kindle. You know, I don't want to recommend the Kindle over other alternatives, but that way of reading is really good when you go on a trip.
So you,
books are so heavy.
What about the beach? Would you take your Kindle to the beach?
Well, I think I would take my Kindle to the beach. Being a klutz, I'll probably get sand in it, and probably that's bad for Kindles. But it hasn't replaced books for me, but it is a nice supplement.
Well, that's cool. So The Art of Fielding by Chad Harbuck. A great read, a really fine book. Probably I will make a reasonably confident prediction. People are going to think of this as a great American novel in the mode of Moby Dick.
It's Philosophy Talk with our annual summer reading show. Let's hear from some of our listeners about what they recommend for philosophical fiction.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Maria.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to talk to you.
Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Buenos Aires, Argentina.
Wow, that's a long ways away. Now, how in the world did you hear about Philosophy Talk, and how do you listen to us?
Well, a friend of mine told me about Philosophy Talk, and I went to your site, and I saw there were I could download podcasts, so I download them. And as I travel back and forth to VA once a week on a van, I listen to your program while traveling.
Oh, wow, that's really cool. So this is our summer reading show, and there's a book you want to talk to us about? What book would you want our listeners to put on their summer reading list?
Well, I suggested The Reader by Bernhard Schlink.
Well, I think that's a great book. Matter of fact, I read it both in German and in English because I thought it would be a good book to work on my German with after seeing the movie. I thought the book was even better than the movie, but why don't you tell us what you liked about it?
Well, I liked very specially the part where the young man, as a lawyer, as a new lawyer, he attends the trial, and he suddenly realizes what's the matter, and the fact is that the woman cannot read. And he wonders whether he should tell the judge, and he asks his father, who's a philosopher teacher and works on Kant, obviously, and the father says that it's the woman's choice and not his choice, and that boy says, well, but she would be happier. And the father says, we're not talking about happiness here. We are talking about dignity, which I think is extremely important.
I think that's an important contrast, happiness versus dignity. But I think we need some of the backstory. John, I know you've read this novel. What's the backstory of The Reader to set these issues up?
Well, basically, the key woman is an illiterate who, during World War II, desperately in need of a job, ended up working in a concentration camp and with moving concentration camp people from one place to another. A tragedy happened. Later, after the war, she's a streetcar conductor and she meets a 15-year-old boy and they have an affair. Later, the 15-year-old boy is at law school and as part of his law school training goes to a trial and lo and behold, she is on trial for the events during World War II. At that point, he realizes putting together things that happened during their affair and putting together her demeanor during the trial that this woman cannot read and that she signed a confession, which is being used against her, that she didn't understand. He goes to his father, a philosophy professor, and asks what he should do, and the philosophy professor says it's her decision. That's the key moment in the book.
Well, that's true. That's true. But I think the climactic moment in the movie, as opposed to the book, is when she puts to the court and to everybody in attendance, what would you have done? Mm-hmm. Right.
Exactly. And it's very interesting. She actually asks the judge out in her very simple attitude. She says, well, what would you have done? Now, this is very uncommon because normally people don't ask questions to the judge. And the book says that the whole audience was quite frustrated, to say the least, about the judge's reply, who paid absolutely no attention to this very deep question.
Right. You're bringing out this autonomy kind of issue. This woman, she can't read. She's in this desperate strait. But basically, the lawyer, the father, and the guy say it's her decision. What does she want to be? I mean, she's got all this stuff. How does she want to narrate her life? Does she want to save herself by pointing out this thing of which she's deeply ashamed? Or would she rather go to her punishment, keeping that to herself and bearing up under it? I think that is a profound issue.
And let me just mention that Bernard Schlink, the author of the book, also has written a number of mystery novels, some of which have been translated, and they're very good reads, too. Maybe not quite as deep as The Reader, but very entertaining.
So, Maria, thank you for that's a great suggestion, The Reader by Bernard Schlink. Great summer reading, and all the way from Buenos Aires at that. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much for calling. Bye.
I wasn't sure what you'd learned.
Well, I have learned, kid. I've learned to read.
It's Philosophy Talk with our annual summer reading show. Let's get another listener's recommendation for philosophical summer reading.
Bridget, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you.
So, Bridget, where are you calling from?
Wenatchee, Washington.
So, what book do you want to recommend to us?
Open City by Teju Cole.
Tell us the backstory of the novel. Tell us what it's about. And then convince our philosophically minded listeners that this should be on their summer reading list because it's a philosophically minded book.
Okay, so it's from the narrator's perspective, who is a Nigerian-German psychiatrist living in New York. And I'm not going to sell you with the plot, because the plot is basically that Julius, the narrator, walks around New York City and occasionally interacting with people and really just thinking about things, history, New York, identity, and we sort of get to live in his brain and hear all of these thoughts throughout the book.
This is one of these very modernist kind of novels, right? Not much happens outwardly.
It is, but it's a page-turner. That's what's so weird. There's not like, oh my gosh, what's going to happen, but it's hard to put it down.
But there must be some philosophical thoughts in his brain.
Yes. Yes, there are a lot of philosophical thoughts in his brain. And a lot of it that I was most interested in, he talks a lot about, you know, how do we, particularly Americans, but how do we identify ourselves in a post-9/11 world? And so he really looks at places, particularly New York, as palimpsests. You know, what was here first, and then it's rewritten, and then how do we identify ourselves with each of those rewritings? So we get to know a little bit about Julius, but really we get to know more about what Julius thinks about the world, or how he doesn't know much about the world except, you know, what we experience through his eyes.
Do we encounter other people in this, or is it just Julius and his ruminations?
No, you do encounter other people. He doesn't have a lot of close relationships, but the ones he does have are interesting. He goes to visit his college professor quite a lot, and they have, you know, these really sort of interesting, deep discussions. And then briefly, he travels to Brussels, and he ends up befriending an internet cafe owner who did his dissertation work on, you know, literary theory, and is always talking about Deleuze and I think Derrida at one point. So the people he encounters are really interesting people that want to have interesting conversations.
So let me see if I've got this straight. So Teju Cole is a Nigerian who's moved to America. He's written a novel about a German psychiatrist.
Nigerian-German.
Oh, a Nigerian-German psychiatrist. Okay, so that's an interesting combination. And it takes place in New York City and in Brussels.
Yes.
Well, it sounds like just a fascinating book from the nationalities and personalities and places involved. And, you know, I'm going to put it on my summer reading list.
Well, I'm going to put it on my summer list if you can tell me one thing. Tell me a new insight, a new thought that you took away from this, a new realization.
What you're looking for, but the new thought I took away from it was that I could read 200 or so pages of thoughts like that, of work that I had read from other people, and be absolutely engrossed, and it was beautifully written. And to be honest, I find a lot of writing about issues like this really dense, you know, a lot of times really alienating, and just kind of like I'm slogging through it. And for this, it was beautifully written, and just really difficult to put down. Part of it's a new thought. It's a new way of reading, I guess.
So basically, you found a page turner where you least expected it.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Mm-hmm.
So, Bridget, calling us from Wenatchee, Washington, thanks for your suggestion of Teju Cole's Open City.
Thank you.
This is Philosophy Talk. We're compiling our 7th annual summer reading list.
In our next segment, we'll hear suggestions for interesting works of nonfiction. We'll hear from two of our favorite psychologists, Timothy Pitchell and Allison Gopnik.
More summer reading picks when Philosophy Talk continues.
I'll be standing up, sitting down in the tub on the plane. I've been turning pages since I first met Dick and Jane.
We're leafing through thoughtful books on our annual summer reading show. I'm John Perry, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence, and I'm Ken Taylor.
We're joined now by Tim Pitchell. He's a professor of psychology at Carleton University. And he's the author of The Procrastinator's Digest, a concise guide to solving the procrastination puzzle. Welcome, Tim, to Philosophy Talk. Where are you calling from?
John, I'm in Ottawa. I'm in the nation's capital, downtown, actually.
You're in a nation's capital.
Oh, I'm in the nation's capital.
So, Tim, what do you want to recommend to our listening audience that they put on their summer reading list?
Well, Alfred Mealy is one of my favorite philosophers in terms of the psychology or philosophy of action, and he just published a new book with Oxford University Press called Backsliding, Understanding Weakness of Will. So that's my recommendation for this summer. It's 121 pages. And in parts, it makes my head ache because a philosopher wrote it, of course, and he makes you think hard. But in other places, it just speaks so clearly to me.
So I'm a little bit surprised that a psychologist finds a philosopher's writings on the philosophy of action interesting and rewarding. Tell us a little more about how philosopher's writings round out your understanding of things.
Well, I find that philosophers always raise better questions and they think through assumptions better. And so, you know, in most of Al's work, he's been challenging people like Davidson and Holton and others who kind of say that, you know, weakness of will isn't possible, and or weakness of will involves violation of intentions or changing your intentions. And he sees things more in line with how I see things emerge in my psychological research, which is interesting. And he's more recently done some experimental philosophy where he's asked people what they think, and lo and behold, he finds things similar to I find in my own research. So I use him to think through the issues of, well, what does it mean to have a problem with weakness of will?
So you and John, we've got here two of the world's leading experts, one a psychologist, one a philosopher, on the subject of procrastination, which is related, I think, I'm not sure whether you both think, to the question of weakness of will.
That's a very good question, Ken, but let me clarify. Tim Pitchell is an expert on procrastination, a leading expert. I am a leading practitioner of procrastination, which is just a little bit different.
Yeah.
Well, you also have the most well-read essay on the internet about procrastination.
Well, I don't know if you know this, Tim, but he's about to have the most well-read book on procrastination. He's got a forthcoming book on the art of procrastination. But anyway, what's the relationship between this? Well, first, explain to our listeners what you mean by weakness of the will.
Well, you know, in terms of how Al Mealy is defining it, he defines it in every chapter, and he begins by saying core weak-willed actions as free, sane, intentional action that, and he adds this interesting clause, and it's important, as the non-depressed agent consciously recognizes the time of action is contrary to better judgment, a judgment based on practical reasoning. So in other words, we reason that this is our best interest, this is our best judgment to do A at a certain time, and along comes that time, and we do B instead.
Now, his definition has an element you don't usually hear, that non-depressed element. Could you tell us a little bit about that? Is that a good idea?
Well, I think it is. Psychologists would say that if I know someone is clinically depressed, I wouldn't talk about their procrastination. I'd want to treat their depression first, and Al says the same thing here. And so there's a lot of gray area, I think, in terms of what do you mean by depressed? When is listlessness make it so that you're not blameworthy anymore, that you don't have to feel that you could have done otherwise.
Well, now, suppose I were to say, well, procrastination is obviously closely related to weakness of the will, but I could think that doing A was the best thing to do now, and not do it now, and that would be weakness of the will. But if I say it's the best thing to do now, but I'm not going to not do it until later, that would be procrastination complicating weakness of the will. How about that?
Well, I think that that's a lot of the arguments here about when intentions change, if they really change, is that weakness of will because you no longer hold a resolution? Holton thinks that, Richard Holton thinks that. I don't think that that's the way Al's presenting it, and so I invite your listeners to wrestle with these things in Al's new book.
It's a short book. It's a philosophical book, maybe a little bit tough going, but probably it's not an expensive book. A little bit of sand on the pages won't hurt, so it sounds like a really good candidate for our summer reading list.
I think so, and it has very good examples in it. So he takes apart weakness of will by giving us everyday examples about whether it be drinking or deciding whether you're going to go into a strip club when you think that's not where you belong. Or he has some great examples of what when you intend to study and you know it's your best judgment that you should study and you go to a party instead. And so I don't think there's a listener alive who wouldn't say, so how does he make sense of this?
So this sounds like a fascinating book by Al Mealy, Backsliding, Understanding Weakness of Will. You know what? And it's something I want to understand. So, Tim, I'm going to take it to the beach. I don't usually get headaches with when I'm reading philosophy, but I'm going to take some aspirin with me just in case.
Yeah, you won't get a headache. It's just for us psychologists who don't think so deeply, I think.
So, Tim Pitchell, thanks so much for joining us and making a recommendation for our summer reading list.
Thanks, John. I look forward to reading your new book, and thanks to you and Ken for a great podcast. I listen to it weekly.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're putting together our annual summer reading list.
Up next, Allison Gopnik, a professor of psychology at UC Berkeley. She's a prolific author. Her most recent book is The Philosophical Baby, What Children's Minds Tell Us About Truth, Love, and the Meaning of Life. Allison, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Well, always glad to be on Philosophy Talk.
So, Allison, what are you planning to take to the beach with you and read this summer?
Well, I'm actually about to go to New Zealand for 3 weeks, so I'm going to be spending my summer in the winter, and I'm going to be reading a fantastic new book that just came out from a developmental psychologist named Paul Harris, who's actually in the School of Education at Harvard, and it's called Trusting What You're Told. And what this book is about a whole aspect of knowledge that I think maybe philosophers haven't thought about as much as they might, which is the kind of knowledge that we get just from listening to other people and believing what they say.
So this is a book about knowledge by what philosophers called testimony written by a psychologist?
Exactly. That's right.
So look, let me ask you a question. What's the psychologist angle about knowledge by testimony? Philosophers worry about whether something that you are told can really count as knowledge. I mean, whether it counts as evidence, whether it's rational to believe the testimony of other people, whether if somebody else knows something and tell you, you thereby know it, and they try to analyze knowledge such that it can give you knowledge by testimony. I assume that's not the kind of issue so much that concerns psychologists when they think about testimony, or is it?
Well, they're not irrelevant. So the kinds of issues that developmental psychologists want to raise, for example, which are not irrelevant, are children, for instance, just uniformly credulous? So do they believe anything that someone tells them? And Paul has done a lot of really beautiful experimental empirical work showing that even 3- and 4-year-olds are quite sensitive about what the status is of the person who's telling them something. So, for instance, if someone misleads them several times, then they discount testimony from that person in the future. That's kind of a good, intelligent piece of news. Perhaps somewhat more depressing piece of news is they're more likely to trust someone who comes from their own group, who they identify with or who they think is similar to themselves, than they are to trust someone who comes from what looks like an outsider group.
Well, that might be pretty relevant to the philosophical literature, because if testimony is going to communicate knowledge, it has to be somehow reliable. It has to be carrying information. And if you just look at testimony, you know, probabilistically or statistically, there's so much lying and confabulation and confusion that goes on, it's hard to see how it could be reliable. But if there are certain situations in which it is, and we're actually attuned to those, then you can make the case that there's a tighter connection between the belief and the truth of the thing believed, even if it goes through testimony, than you might think otherwise.
Well, I think what's really fascinating about Paul's book empirically is it shows that children may be starting out with some of these very general principles for trying to find reliable sources, like maybe just a principle that a mom or a caregiver or someone who looks you in the eye
is likely to be a reliable source of testimony. But as I say, they very quickly start sorting out things so that, for instance, someone who deceives you several times, that will get discounted. On the other hand, part of why this book is so interesting is it looks at things like children's magical beliefs or their religious beliefs. And it's interesting that those are cases where clearly the information is coming through testimony. And yet that information seems to be sticky. It seems to be a kind of information that children, and then, of course, we adults, integrate into our sense of what's true in the world. And I think it's a very interesting question about why whole belief systems like religion that are just completely based on testimony stick and have credence and are treated as knowledge, whereas you might think that the fact that those systems didn't fit, say, what you actually experienced with your own eyes would make them more dubious. So a lot of what Paul is talking about is what happens in development that makes children so interestingly skeptical and rational in some ways and then so credulous in other ways.
You're asking a really deep question. I mean, and it's really fascinating because this is Descartes' question. See, because Descartes thought that there was a dark side to belief based on authority, because authority gives you all this mythology and all this stuff that you know, and he wanted knowledge to basically to be based on the individual rational inquirer thinking through things for himself. That was what all the meditations was about. It was supposed to lay waste, you know, authority-driven cultures and all that stuff. But lately people have come to see that's an impossible task. But you're pointing out that even though it's an impossible task to build up our beliefs from bottom up just through the exercise of our own individual rationality, we do rely on others. Descartes was right. There is a dark side to belief driven by authority.
Well, it could be that we just, you know, and after all, you could argue it doesn't hurt us, and maybe it does help us to have certain kinds of untrue beliefs, particularly, and this is another point that Paul Harris makes in the book, particularly social beliefs. So you could argue that some kinds of social traditions or culture, they're not really about whether something's true or not. It's whether something's something that everyone in the whole society can accept. It's about the way that we do things here rather than being about the way that things are. And that's an example where learning from testimony and learning from authority might be the only way to learn. So there isn't really another way to learn what is significant in my culture or what the polite way of asking for something is, for instance.
That's true. So what's the name of this book again?
So the name of the book is Trusting What You're Told, How Children Learn from Others by Paul Harris.
So Allison, I'm going to read this book, and while I read this book, I'm going to think of you not lying on the beach, but cooped up in some warm room next to a fireplace, sipping cocoa in New Zealand and reading your next book. So thanks a lot for the suggestion.
Well, I'm extremely proud to think of myself as being a friend of Philosophy Talk and of Ken and John. Thanks for having me on.
UC Berkeley psychologist Allison Gopnik and her pick for philosophical reading this summer. You can find all the books we've talked about on the show today, as well as many more suggestions from our many friends, over at our website, philosophytalk.org.
You can also sign up there to get the free weekly podcast of Philosophy Talk. And now, we take a quick summer stroll with Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, you know you can go into a bookstore, get the ISBN of the book you want, then order it on your smartphone from Amazon and save money in the book. Do it in front of the clerks, just to show them what a smart shopper you are. Or better yet, order the Kindle version in front of them and start reading it right there in the bookstore. Of course, not long from now, there won't be any bookstores, just warehouses, which is how I look at an e-book reader. It's a vast warehouse you can hold on your hand. Remember, though, unlike an actual book, you do not own any of the items in that warehouse. Amazon has been known to remove content. Back in 2009, they recalled two books by George Orwell because, spokesman said, quote, these books were added to our catalog by a third party who did not have the rights to the books. When we are notified of this by the rights holder, we removed the illegal copies from our systems and from customers' devices and refunded customers, unquote. There was an outcry, of course. Spokesman said, not to worry, quote, we are changing our systems so that in the future we will not remove books from customers' devices in these circumstances, unquote. But the thing is, they can remove those books. Amazon is also crushing independent booksellers in its path, many of them by partnering with them. You can get that vast Amazon customer base if you partner with them, but you also get this. Amazon charges a 15% transaction fee, a profit you don't get. Amazon gets a relationship with the customer, not you. Suddenly, you're just a supplier with no control over special promotions or other incentives to buy a book. Amazon also takes a chunk out of the shipping fees. Oh, and then there's Amazon's resistance to sales taxes, thus withholding money from various state revenues. And Amazon is predatory. They sell ebooks at $9.99, below cost, a tactic, it is said, designed to force smaller companies also to reduce their prices and drive them out of business. Amazon pushes publishers to further drop the price of ebooks. This drives sales of ebooks and forces publishers to shift their fixed costs to print books, which further drives readers away from actual books to cheaper ebooks, which Amazon pretty much owns. Well, that's okay, I guess. Capitalism in action. Many things that weren't really broken have disappeared from the marketplace, including record albums, cassettes, 8-tracks, video cassettes, laserdiscs, CDs, DVDs, and now books. My question is, when people come over the house, what will be there to see? No books, no movies, no CDs. The walls will be bare. You're living like a monk. Used to be, if you wanted a person to be impressed, seduction-wise, it'd be, oh, you like Borges. Oh, you like Coltrane. Oh, you have all of Kurosawa's movies. Now, oh, you have a flat screen in an otherwise vacant living room. Be still my heart. I gotta go.
The Wisdom of the Ages, in a nutshell, from Ian Scholes, the 60-Second Philosopher.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2012.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. The director of research is Laura McGuire.
Thanks also to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Dave Millar, Jimmy Tobin, Corey Goldman, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Templeton Foundation and from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk,
and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.